Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. I don't think I knew what a Zoom meeting was back in early March. And then a week later, it felt like my entire life was one long Zoom meeting. And everybody is using Zoom as a verb. Faces in a box, trying to talk to each other. You're muted. Oh no, I'm muted.
Oh, am I creating feedback?
I can't hear you. I think the internet connection is bad.
Hey guys, thank you for being with us today. We've got a... Hello, can you hear me? Guys?
Everybody was trying to figure things out while keeping their distance. Somehow, we learned a whole new way of life on the fly. It's been a rough road. We've lost loved ones. People have lost their jobs, livelihoods, and their businesses. But in some areas, the pandemic has accelerated innovation and learning. So what are some of the things that we may do differently from now on because we realized it's actually better? And what are some things that maybe we'll never do again? On today's show, what's here to stay and what may be gone forever? Let's start with work. For me, working from home was difficult and really stressful. Trying to find windows of quiet between figuring out fourth and fifth grade math, denying demands for pancakes and grilled cheese sandwiches, refereeing arguments between my son and my daughter, working late into the night or super early in the morning just to find time to focus. I kept my productivity the same, but it came at a cost. Researchers have been looking at this moment in global labor history like a field experiment. For some, it's been bad news. But for others, like reporter Jad Slaman, working from home has been a really pleasant experience. Many companies are now considering whether employees should ever return to their cubicles. What do we know about the impact of working from home? Jad picks it up from here.
For me, work from home has kind of been a wonderland. Sure, there's the gnawing dread of a major public health crisis and the economic impact. I worry about my health and losing my job, but I have my cat. I have my piano. I have vodka and a PlayStation right here at what's become work. I do interviews in my yard on a milk crate wearing the same shirt I've worn all week. I record stories, this one included, in my closet. I don't set an alarm most days, waking mostly when the sunbeam creeps from my floor to my pillow. I've also felt more focused, more productive, and I've actually produced more stories than usual during this time. It's incredible, and I very honestly never want it to end. So I set out to see, well, does it have to? Should it? I started by talking to Stanford economics professor Nicholas Bloom. He first started looking into work from home back in 2011 when he found out the unassuming middle-aged Asian student in back of his class was the founding CEO of a giant Chinese company.
It was quoted at that time on NASDAQ, worth about $15 billion.
The company was Ctrip, a Chinese travel booking service akin to Expedia or Priceline. At the time, it had 15,000 employees. The student was entrepreneur James Liang.
James himself was worth like, I don't know, half a billion. I looked him up online and it the first hit that came up was China's 500 richest people, and he was definitely not 500 either.
During a class discussion, James said his company was thinking about work from home. They were expanding and feeling growing pains.
They were paying a fortune for this huge office in downtown Shanghai.
The question for Ctrip wasn't, are we going to take a loss during work from home? It was how big of a loss it would be. Is work from home going to save us enough in rent money to be worth it on balance?
So their view was, some share of people would start watching the Chinese version of Jerry Springer or Oprah Winfrey or set up their own eBay online firm. You know, this, the saying is the three great enemies of working from home are the fridge, the television, and the bed.
Nicholas was intrigued. He'd been studying what he called, quote, being nice to people, work policies, and asked James if he could tag along back to China and see how it all played out as part of a study. James had lived and worked in the U.S., and his Shanghai offices turned out to be very American, what Nicholas calls a Dilbertian nightmare, like the comic strip.
Cubicles, you know, canteens, 6-7 floors, probably 3-4,000 people in that office.
The daily grind was typical office work, phone calls with clients, dealing with web issues. The company did a pseudo-pilot study of work from home with only 5 employees, and the results were promising.
People worked harder because their parents made them work harder.
Armed with that insight, Ctrip scaled up, asked for volunteers to work from home, and got some 500.
We took the 500 and you randomized them by even and odd birthdays. So people with even birthdays, so if you're born on like the 2nd, the 4th, the 6th, the 8th of the month, go home for 9 months and the odds stay in the office.
So 9 months of travel booking later, Nicholas had the results.
The firm was like amazed. It was not remotely what they're expecting.
When they crunched the numbers, it turned out the homebodies were 13% more productive than the office workers. It was easy to tell by looking at booking numbers, client calls. To put that all in perspective, it's like each and every one of them was working a Saturday half day every week at no cost.
They calculated they were increasing profits by about $2,000 for each employee that was working from home.
So much for the Chinese Jerry Springer. Nicholas looked into where the boost came from. First off, 9 to 5 actually became 9 to 5. Workers worked their full hours.
And the reason is, you know, they weren't hit by commuting problems or their motorbike broke down or they took a long lunch break or they had to leave early to go to the doctors at home. There was much less of those interruptions.
There was much less of any kind of interruption.
They were just more productive per minute, and they said it was quieter and easier to concentrate.
An important caveat here is the volunteers had spare rooms that they could dedicate to work. It's a luxurious solitude not everyone forced into working from home has right now. I'm lucky enough to live alone, only having to deal with my cat begging me to throw her ball. Nicholas, on the other hand, has human children in his workplace.
My youngest is 4, she regularly, I mean, like, this is like 5 to 10 times a day, comes into my office shouting, doo-doo, doo-doo, which is her nickname for me, you know. I'm bored, I want to play, come with me. And then I say, I've got a phone call, I have to work. And she's like, why do you have to work? And I say, daddy has to earn money. Why do you need the money? I have money. She has this like pot of, you know, cents and 2 cents and nickels and dimes.
In his research on Ctrip, Dudu also found way fewer people quit, which was noteworthy since the company had pretty high churn at the time. It seems to suggest that once people started working from home, they started enjoying their jobs more. That's been true for me during these past few months of working from home, and I think it has to do with what I can do when I'm not working. I can take naps.
So I'm just gonna go ahead and set an alarm.
I don't think I've ever gotten so much sleep in my adult life. And sleep scientist Sarah Alger tells me I probably needed it.
Interestingly, if you subjectively measure it, you ask somebody, do you feel tired? Do you feel like you're not performing at your best? A lot of times they're very inaccurate.
Sarah works at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research.
Oh no, I'm fine. I had 4 hours of sleep last night, but I'm great. But then you objectively test them and no, they're not great. They are really showing impairments in their performance.
I tell her about this joyless, solemn cup of coffee I used to have every day in the office pre-pandemic, right around 2 p.m. I got it from our office machine, piping hot, and put in a few ice cubes just to down it like a kid taking cough medicine. Without it, I would get this crazy urge to nap under my desk that I'd have to fight for the rest of the day. Sarah says I was fighting nature.
Your circadian cycle has a natural dip in the afternoon. And so a lot of people think this is the post-lunch dip and it has to do with them having had a big lunch. But it's really the natural dip in your circadian rhythm when both your homeostatic pressure or need for sleep and your circadian dip in alertness coincide. That's just the best time to try to get one in there.
She's talking about taking a nap. Yeah, for a 30-year-old professional. Sarah's been pushing naps in the workplace for years.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that when you go to sleep, it's not like a computer. So you're not shutting your brain off. The brain is actually very active.
She breaks it down for me. A short power nap, like 20 minutes, gives your brain something caffeine cannot.
Sleep spindles.
They're bursts of brain waves that last half a second or so. You can actually see muscle twitching associated with it.
That are thought to help reactivate memory traces.
The more you remember, the more you learn. Sarah says napping is good for companies. It can boost productivity and problem solving, and it's got these real health benefits for employees. But even if you're not into napping, working from home could mean that you could use your time more effectively under any circumstance.
I mean, being British, you know, many times I've come into work with a stinking hangover and, you know, by 2 p.m, I'm done. So then the question is, if I'm in the office, I kind of feel like I should stick around. If I'm at home, quite honestly, I just, you know, clock off.
That's Nicholas Bloom again from Stanford.
I can actually productively use that time. I can maybe go clean or do the laundry or, you know, go for a run.
That's not the kind of thing you can do when you're working in an office. When my brain was fried, I would just scroll through bits of Reddit I'd already seen or stare at YouTube videos on autoplay. Nicholas says it's okay for our brains to need breaks.
We all know it's very hard to concentrate all the time. There's lots of studies that psychologists do about there's only so much energy, I believe, your brain can put into allowing you to concentrate.
He says work from home lets us just kind of accept that and fall into a more natural rhythm of work and rest.
So my day is structured slightly differently. I start earlier, work for a bit, go for a run, work for a while, actually see my kids over dinner in the early evening, and then sometimes work a bit later at night.
Talking work from home with Nicholas, it sounded like all this was a win-win all around. But then he tells me about what happened after the C-Trip study.
End of the 9-month experiment, when they rolled it out to the entire firm, 50% of the original group that volunteered to go home and had been at home for 9 months decided they wanted to come back into the office. You know, the big complaint was loneliness and depression.
It turned out that, especially among the younger workers, being home meant this social loss. Nicholas says work for them was this important part of their social lives.
So, you know, if you're born in Philly and go to a university in New York and you're working, say, in San Francisco, you may not know a lot of people in San Francisco, and your workplace is a key part of your social life. And if you're cut off from it, it's painful, actually.
Nicholas's study found choice is hugely important when it comes to work from home. With C-Trip, after the workers who wanted to go back to the office left the experimental group, the productivity of the hardcore homebodies on average actually rose again to 25%. Like they were working full Saturdays every week. So there's a real case for permanent work from home for some people. Laura Hambly is an organizational and industrial psychologist who tries to figure out who those people are. To figure out if work from home will work, Laura uses a kind of personality test. Introverts, perhaps unsurprisingly, do very well. For them, just being at work takes work.
It's because there's people all around, and there's interruptions and conversations, and they may like people, but they need to recharge from that. So they feel kind of, when they're working from home, it's kind of a dream for them in terms of they get that focus, they get the time on their own.
That's kind of me. After 2 years on the job, I can count my water cooler conversations on one hand. Laura also found confident workers thrive as well. Those with high task confidence, as in, you don't typically need to ask a colleague to look over your work.
So someone who's new in their career and just starting their very first job, and then COVID hits, and they're not a confident person to begin with, this would be difficult. Remote work would put them in a very awkward situation.
She found, though, that most people are somewhere in the middle, most productive with a few days in the office and a few at home, which jibes coincidentally with what public health experts want in the new normal. Staggered shifts, reduced occupancy. The bottom line, though, she says, is most people won't know until they try it. If there's any silver lining in this mass work-from-home experience, it's that more people are trying it, forced to get over this fear.
It's fear that people aren't productive, but you should be able to know whether people are productive based on how you evaluate their performance and how you measure performance, regardless of whether you see them or not.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman.
We're talking about what's here to stay or gone forever in the wake of the pandemic. And we wanted to hear from all of you. Work was a big topic. We got this audio note from Catherine Conda.
What's here to stay for me is my lunchtime walk or workout. I have found I'm so much more productive in the afternoons than I ever was working from my office, where I often ate at my desk and barely moved for 9 hours. I feel so much better, and bonus, I can get away with wearing workout clothes on those days I don't have video calls.
Our next take comes from a germ expert, Connie Steed. She is a registered nurse and president of the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology.
Basically, infection preventionists, as simple as I can put it, are considered like germ detectives.
We asked Connie to give us some predictions. Liz Tung has more.
The first thing Connie says is we need to face facts.
I think that things won't go back completely to the way they were. I think that we're going to have a new normal.
In some ways, that new normal will mean less of some of the things we like. For instance, sharing food. It's a pretty good bet that potlucks, buffets, and self-serve salad bars will be going on hiatus. As for nightlife, we can say goodbye to dance clubs and hookah bars, and we'll have to live with a little less music in our lives. Experts say singing, especially in groups, is risky business, which means you should just say no to concerts, choirs, and especially karaoke. At least the kind where you drunkenly belt songs into a shared mic with a bunch of friends. What Connie says is here to stay, masks, or at least they should be.
Some type of integration of routine mask wearing in public and the work setting, at least for right now.
Also here to stay, living in a state of constant paranoia about the cleanliness of our hands.
Keep your hands away from your face and clean your hands.
On the plus side, Connie predicts a silver lining in our future. Fewer icky buttons to push.
An increase in no-touch technology. In other words, you pay for your groceries using your card, and you tap it, and you really have no contact with money or with anything. The no-touch light switches or voice-activated light switches.
And speaking of no-touch, the handshake may become a thing of the past. Even Dr. Fauci is pushing for it to be retired.
I don't think we ever should ever shake hands ever again, to be honest with you.
On the plus side, Connie says we're already seeing alternatives starting to emerge.
I've seen elbow pumps instead of handshaking, peace signs or holding up a thumb, and those kinds of things. So it wouldn't surprise me if we do see more acknowledgement that does not include physical contact.
We've all gotten used to virtual meetings for work, but Connie says that kind of technology could even play a role in physical social gatherings when 6 feet away just doesn't seem far enough.
When we had our family over at the house for Memorial Day, we stayed in the backyard, but our older grandparents, their great-grandparents, my mother and dad, were remotely with us via Zoom in the yard, on a screen. They could still participate, but we were protecting them.
Some families have even started doing weekly Zoom or phone chats, which Connie says could actually lead to more communication and newfound intimacy in one another's lives. Unfortunately, the coronavirus has put a real damper on a lot of people's travel plans, but Connie says that's no reason to sit at home. In fact, it could change how we vacation for the long haul.
I wouldn't be surprised to see people do RV vacations.
Lots of people don't feel comfortable getting on a plane, train, or bus these days, or staying in hotels. But with an RV,
you have more control over the environment you're traveling in. So I suspect we might see some increase in that type of vacation, if you will.
Connie says all in all, it's about being aware and paying attention to how we're moving through this new reality.
Just use our heads when we do things.
It'll take a shift in the way we think. But Connie, for one, is convinced we can do it.
We'll still be able to live and survive, so we'll have to adapt. And I think we still have some things to learn.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. We're talking about all of the things we've done differently during the pandemic, what we've learned from this, and which aspects may actually be changed forever. for many couples, the pandemic has meant a lot of togetherness. A lot. Not being able to go out to concerts or ball games for dinner or impromptu meetups with friends. And that can be stressful.
We were not built for 24/7.
That's Helen Fisher. She's a biological anthropologist.
For millions of years, we lived in these little hunting and gathering groups. Men went hunting probably 4 times a week. Sometimes they'd stay out overnight or 2 nights. And women would be gathering their vegetables and fruits and go off and see friends and family in other communities, sometimes for 2 weeks. So this is not the same as living together or being married, because in regular times, even married people who are living together go off and do things. Now we haven't been. So it's a real stress.
Helen says during times of crisis, couples often either grow together or they grow apart.
It pushes you to make your next step in life. So if you're in an unhappy partnership and you're stuck together for quite a while, I think it's going to lead maybe to domestic violence. That is increasing. And I think when this is over, we're going to see more divorce. If you are in a very happy partnership, I think it's going to seal that partnership even more. You've gotten over a very difficult time together. You've learned how to handle an extremely stressful situation. And I think you're going to carry on at a new level of commitment.
Helen says there's a couple of things people can do during these unusual circumstances.
The first thing you got to do if you're living 24/7 with somebody is create some part of your environment where you aren't bothered, where people know that if you're over there, they can't interrupt you. So safe spaces are very important. Daily schedules are very important. There's a whole study of the intolerance of uncertainty. Most people need to know the plan. So you got to make a plan every day. Establish hours of work, establish the dinner hour, establish when you're going to play alone, establish when you're going to play together.
She says it's also a great time to be creative.
In fact, one night, my boyfriend actually, I said, well, let's dress for dinner tonight. And by God, he emerged from the bedroom in his tuxedo. It was just charming. But you can have a Halloween night where you find anything in the house to dress up. You can dance together. You can cook together. Reading time is a good thing. So the resources are there. And a smart couple that wants to stay together is going to find new things to do together and alone. And this will be a period of tremendous growth.
Some couples are facing just incredible stressors right now. Many, many, many people have lost their jobs. People stand to lose their homes or apartments. So how much can a relationship take?
At times of real stress, divorce is high.
Mm-hmm.
Cortisol levels go up. That's a stress hormone. And sometimes you can't sleep. You can just have a very volatile temper. Other people will just give up and be depressed. Bad relationships are very bad for you.
For the couples who come out of this on the other side, intact, still together, what are some things they might take with them and continue to do, or lessons they have learned?
I think they're going to have built a more meaningful partnership. I think there's going to be more self-disclosure. Self-disclosure is very good for you. I mean, when you tell people how you're thinking, how you're feeling, it is apparently very good physiologically for you. It really builds intimacy, actually, and romance and attachment. So I think it's going to lead a new element of being more meaningful in the partnerships. They're just going to have a more genuine partnership. They're going to know, okay, we got through this one. We can get through an awful lot more. But I think what they're really learning is how to compromise, how to live together under extreme circumstances. And I think they're going to come out of this knowing, okay, I'm now in this for the long term. We know what we're doing now.
The pandemic has, of course, not only affected couples who are in committed relationships, it's also changed how we date. Helen is the chief scientist for the dating site Match.com. What have you seen in terms of online dating? Because if people were looking for a partner online before the pandemic hit, this certainly put a major damper on things, right?
Actually, I think it's quite the reverse.
Oh.
What we're really seeing is a rise of a new stage in the courtship process. Prior to this pandemic, singles of all ages met on the internet and then went out and met in person. And now what we're seeing the rise of, a dramatic rise, of courting on the internet.
Before going out on that sometimes awkward first date, Helen says singles are spending hours on Zoom or FaceTime, checking each other out. And she says that's a good development.
First of all, they got time to talk. I mean, even if they're working at home, they're not getting dressed, they're not commuting to work, they're not meeting friends and family after work. They have time to court. They not only have time to court, but when they meet somebody online, they have something meaningful to talk about. You know, an awful lot of first dates are basically chit-chat. And now what they're doing is self-disclosure, saying how you feel, your disappointments, feeling trapped, hoping for something, what you're going to do afterwards is very meaningful. It builds a partnership faster. It brings intimacy to the relationship faster. So they got time to date. They got something to talk about. They're doing more self-disclosure. And there's two very other important elements. One of them is sex is off the table. You know, when you go out and meet somebody without having ever seen them before or talked to them online, you have this sense, well, is he going to kiss me? Should I kiss her? Do we hold hands? Do I walk her to the bus? How do we handle the sex? It's off the table. The other thing that's off the table is money. They don't have to decide, well, are we going to go to a, you know, cheap coffee bar, and or are we going to go to a fancy restaurant? Who's going to pay? Do I offer to split the bill? It's gone. Sex is off the table. Money is off the table. I do think that this is a new stage in the courtship process. And I do think that after this pandemic is over, that stage will remain because people have gotten used to it. And because it saves time, it saves money, and you're going to kiss fewer frogs. Courtship goes on. I mean, romance and attachment and the sex drive will continue. You can't kill the sex drive, but we're going to have more meaningful relationships because we're going to start by talking to them before we hop into the sack. I don't see the downside of that.
Helen Fisher is chief scientist at Match.com and senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. We're talking about what's here to stay and what's maybe gone forever, and we wanted to hear from all of you. We got this note from Jen King. She says she stopped dyeing her hair.
Since then, my roots have grown in. I'm about 50% gray and 50% dark brown or black. And now that salons are opening again, I have a decision to make about whether or not I'm going to go back and color my hair or if I'm going to keep it. And honestly, the longer my roots get, the more I like it. My daughter has told me that her stuffed tiger doesn't like it. And she also told me that I look like Mother Gothel, who is a Disney villain that gets old and her hair gets white, and that's when she's really evil. And I say, you know, I think it looks pretty. I think it looks silvery and shiny, and I really like it. And I think I'm going to keep it this way.
The pandemic has also changed how we eat in so many ways. That was a big topic in the comments we got. No more dinners out, less takeout, and more baking and cooking at home.
Hi, my name is Erica Palin, and when the pandemic ends, I hope there are a couple of new things that I can keep doing. The first is much more detailed meal planning so that I don't have to go to the grocery store multiple times in one week. And kind of related to that, I hope that I can also keep my little green onion plant thriving. I don't see a reason why I should ever have to pay money for green onions ever again. They're growing on my windowsill just fine.
Several people said they'll never go back to the grocery store and just have everything delivered. And it also seems people have a bigger interest now in where their food comes from and in producing their own food. Internet searches on how to garden have nearly doubled compared to past springs. Is this trend here to stay? And will people actually be able to produce significant amounts of food? Grant Hill talked to a man who thinks it's possible.
Long before all of us learned about quarantine living, there was a time when 8 people lived together in the same enclosed space without leaving for 2 years, voluntarily.
8 people, vastly different ages, four men, four women. We came together, each of us wanted to be inside, and we did it. We didn't leave.
This was Biosphere 2, a giant complex greenhouse in the middle of the Arizona desert, which mimicked different climate zones built for testing how humans might live long-term in space. In 1991, researchers sealed 8 volunteers inside Biosphere 2. The mission, survive. Grow your own food. That's where this guy comes in.
Okay, I'm John Jevons. I'm director of Ecology Action.
Up to that point, John had spent nearly 20 years popularizing an agricultural method originally developed in China called biointensive farming.
I asked a question in 1970. I wanted to know what was the smallest area you could grow all your food in an environmentally sound way, in an equitable way, so if everyone in the whole world used that approach or a similarly effective approach, that everyone could live well.
He turned his research into a book.
Yes, the book is now called How to Grow More Vegetables Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine with Less Water. Oh, I better have to do this again.
It has a very detailed title.
How to Grow More Vegetables, Fruits, Nuts, Berries, Grains, and Other Crops Than You Ever Thought Possible with Less Water on Less Land Than You Can Imagine.
That got the attention of those Biosphere 2 researchers. So they tested biointensive farming. The technique prioritizes soil health in raised beds, allowing roots to grow deeper rather than wider. This way, more plants can be packed into a smaller area.
They were able to grow all the food for each of the people in there on 3,300 square feet.
That's per person per year, largely using the biointensive method. For context, experts estimate that today, the typical American diet takes over 100,000 square feet per person per year. Okay, so to be fair, one person inside Biosphere 2 did lose almost 55 pounds, and another was accused of sneaking in food from the outside. But the point is, research conducted by the University of Arizona concluded that the biointensive method was, for the most part, successful. John's method follows 8 core tenets that include composting, trench digging, and most of all, time.
So this isn't a product, it's a process. And it doesn't grow crops, though you grow crops with it. It grows complete diets.
As the pandemic took hold of the U.S., grocery store shelves looked bare, meat production facilities were linked to virus outbreaks. For many families, money got tight, and people started to rethink their food supply and their role in producing it.
There's no question that it can, you know, provide that spark to rethink about how we do things.
And that's happened before during times of crisis.
Of all the weapons the United Nations are using to win this war, food is among the most important. This, then, is a challenge to every loyal American citizen. What can we do to help win the war with food? Victory gardens.
During both world wars, the U.S. government urged citizens to plant gardens to sustain communities all over the country, while durable goods like wheat, canned meat, and sugar were rationed and shipped off to feed troops overseas.
And the victory gardeners around the country produced about 40% of the food. So this can be used in local areas, on vacant lots, on half an acre, on 2 acres, whatever, locally, and it can take care of providing employment, and it can take care of providing food.
Food insecurity is not a new issue for many communities and neighborhoods. Many cities have areas that are food deserts where there are no grocery stores, and healthy food and fresh produce is hard to come by. Way before the pandemic, some communities took matters into their own hands through urban farming.
The neighborhood that we're working in is a 96% African American working class community that's been hit pretty hard by COVID-19.
That's Noelle Warford. She's the executive director of Urban Tree Connection, the organization behind a 3/4-acre farm in the middle of West Philadelphia called Neighborhood Foods Farm. It was built with the help of the community in 2009 on a vacant lot, and it now produces nearly 6,500 pounds of food a year. She says the pandemic really spotlights the importance of this work.
We're seeing urban agriculture across the country just be recognized in a different way, which I think sort of sheds light to many of us who've been doing this work for a long time. It also creates opportunities for people to come into the field.
Noelle thinks the increased interest in food production and independent farming is here to stay.
We're not going to return to some norm for the world that we were in prior to COVID-19. So our work is really beyond food access and really thinking about what does food sovereignty in a neighborhood look like and what does it mean for a community to have control over the production of a critical resource like food.
John Jevons hopes that with more Americans interested in playing an active role in the food chain, people will rediscover the power hidden right below their feet.
Gandhi said, "To forget how to dig the soil is to forget oneself."
That story was reported by Grant Hill. For lots of scientists and researchers, conferences are a big part of life. It's how they learn about what's new in their field and exchange ideas with colleagues. But starting in March, a lot of conferences were canceled or moved online. A virtual conference could turn out like the longest, biggest, and perhaps dullest Zoom meeting ever. But some of these online gatherings were actually a huge success. Alan Yu explores whether online conferences will be here to stay.
When you're organizing a conference about virtual reality, it kind of makes sense to think about having some of it take place in virtual reality rather than in person. That's what Blair McIntyre thought. He's a professor at the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech and the co-chair of a big annual conference on virtual reality. So last year, when he was planning this conference, he figured a virtual environment would allow people to catch up on the latest research, even if they couldn't get to the actual conference. A lot of his colleagues supported this, but there were some critics.
There are people who worry that, you know, if we start making a lot of these events available online, eventually nobody will show up and the whole thing will collapse.
Then this year, the pandemic happened. The virtual reality conference was supposed to be in Atlanta in late March. Blair and his fellow conference organizers now had 2 weeks to put as much of it online as they could. They didn't get a lot of sleep, but they did it. A lot of the sessions could be done with just regular video conferencing, people talking over slides. But some of the sessions happened in virtual reality using a tool called Mozilla Hubs. These particular presenters had VR headsets to track their head and hand gestures, and the audience could see this online. They would see little floating torsos with round heads like Lego minifigures and hands waving.
Thank you very much for coming, and welcome to the presentation of our paper.
You could see the person's head move and see their hands move, and it kind of looked like a real person giving a talk.
Imagine you're in a video game world where you don't race cars or fire machine guns, you listen to lectures. Now, of course, there were some troubles. After all, they only had 2 weeks to plan this.
The cameraman is back, so.
Okay.
That's good.
Shall we carry on regardless?
But by and large, Blair says it worked pretty well. The organizers even replicated the fun part of going to a conference with backgrounds and 3D models.
So you can quickly go and sort of search for martini glass or beer or cheese board. And so people were spawning all kinds of party things in there.
And if you measure success by how many people showed up, then this conference did great.
So instead of the 1,000-odd people that we normally get, we had over 2,000 people this year. And there's lots of people who, you know, normally would never have been able to go. So we had representation from 50-some-odd countries instead of the 30-some-odd we had last year. We had 27% women instead of 17%. You know, so the demographics were much more balanced, had a much broader representation, which was great.
It can be hard to get to an in-person conference for many reasons. You might need a visa to another country, your workplace to give you time and money, access to childcare. Of course, there are some aspects of a conference that cannot be moved online, even if you had the very best VR setup available.
It's not going to be the same as us standing, you know, in a line to get coffee or sitting at a restaurant or a bar chatting.
An online conference removes that element of chance. But Blair also said that at the virtual conference he helped to organize, he chatted with a lot more people because he no longer had to hang out and hope to run into someone. Some scientists have been calling for online alternatives to conferences since way before the pandemic, like climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe.
A number of years ago, when I first stepped on the carbon scale, so to speak, to measure my carbon footprint, I was surprised to realize that the biggest part of my carbon footprint was my travel. And not vacation travel, but travel to scientific meetings, conferences, and to talk to people about climate change.
Air travel accounts for about 2.5% of global carbon dioxide emissions. So she decided to give the vast majority of her talks virtually. She would only fly somewhere if she could line up several talks in the same region. She hopes that some of the lessons learned during the pandemic will have a lasting impact.
This pandemic has taught us that while we are physically distancing, we can socially connect online in ways that we might not have fully explored before.
The benefits of virtual scientific gatherings could go beyond a reduced carbon footprint. Climate scientist Nader Jivanji noticed that with a group called Journal Club. It's like a book club, except it's all climate scientists talking about scientific journal articles to catch up with the latest research. The Journal Club had to go online. And at the start of each virtual meeting, everyone would first type out their reaction or questions to the article they had all read.
And so then, after 5 minutes, we've got 24 really thoughtful comments from a cross-section of people in the conversation, and often, and sometimes people we wouldn't have heard from otherwise. You know, people who may be a little bit more reluctant to raise their hand or interrupt someone in a live meeting.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Coming up, your doctor will see you now online.
It's just so much easier and less time-consuming to open up your laptop and see your doctor online.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about things that are different now in the wake of the pandemic. What's here to stay? What's maybe changed forever? And we wanted to hear from all of you and got this note from Dana DiFilippo.
I really like telehealth, and I hope that telehealth continues after the pandemic and quarantine end. It's just so much easier and less time-consuming to open up your laptop and see your doctor online than to schlep to the doctor's office, wait for them to call you back, wait in the room for the doctor to come, then check out. Telehealth just is such an easier, quicker process.
Healthcare has changed so much during the pandemic. Many hospitals saw massive surges of COVID patients, but are also experiencing huge financial losses because they were not seeing other patients for more routine surgeries. I recently talked to a CEO of a health system, and he said, you know, we just have to learn how to coexist with the virus, meaning offer the services that our patients need while keeping everybody safe. One idea that could fit the bill is called hospital at home. Dan Gorenstein explored that topic in his podcast, Trade-Offs.
Providing hospital-level care in people's homes seems like an innovation tailor-made for this moment.
I think it was Milton Friedman who said, when a crisis hits, people look for ideas that have just been laying around. And this has been laying around for a while.
Physician and researcher Bruce Leff began studying the feasibility of hospitalizing patients with simple conditions like pneumonia and heart failure at home back in the 90s. Bruce says it's obvious the coronavirus has put hospitals in a bind.
So emergency room visits are down in many hospitals because people are afraid to go to the hospital.
The number of visits to the ER has dropped by about one third.
Most have sat empty while others have been overrun.
I think what's become apparent to a bunch of folks is the need to create surge capacity in a way that doesn't totally bankrupt you.
Bruce thinks hospital-at-home programs can act as a kind of pressure valve. The typical model combines in-home visits and treatments with telehealth. It can be used to replace an inpatient stay altogether or to end one early, completing recovery at home, including for COVID patients. So hospitals can be ready for a winter wave and keep seeing patients, bringing in cash.
I think folks are seeing that there's a need to create capacity in a way that aligns with business models, and I think hospital at home can do that. You can ramp up and you can pull it back.
The other benefit to hospital at home? Evidence. 20 years of it. And Bruce says it's rigorous and it's strong.
So in meta-analyses where you take a bunch of small randomized controlled trials and you group them together, mortality at 6 months is about 20% lower for hospital at home compared to typical hospital care. I think if you were to ask most patients when they're in the emergency department and given the choice and you say to them, hey, you know, if you go home, you have a 20% lower risk of being dead in 6 months. That's pretty compelling.
In the most recent randomized controlled trial, the first one done in the US, home stays also proved 40% cheaper, and they were 3 times less likely to end up back in the hospital within 30 days. Until now, executives have been slow to design hospital-to-home programs. As of today, just a few dozen hospitals offer the service, less than 1% of America's 6,000 hospitals. But the coronavirus may be changing the game.
There's been a tremendous amount of interest in the program.
We've had about 9 major conversations taking place.
Travis Messina,
the founder and chief executive officer of Contessa,
and Rafael Rakowski,
one of the co-founders and CEO of Medically Home,
head the companies that are the front runners in a small but burgeoning sector selling hospital-at-home support services. Moving care safely out of a billion-dollar high-tech hospital and into a bunch of people's homes is no small feat. And while hospitals can do it, not everyone wants to do it.
If I'm totally candid, does every health system in America have the ability to run a home recovery care program on their own? Absolutely. I think the question that they need to ask themselves is at the highest and best use of their time and their capital.
Both companies provide a similar suite of services, handling the supply chain, training, tech, and other logistics, leaving hospital staff to focus on delivering the care. Contessa recently helped Mount Sinai in New York double their program size in response to COVID, and Medically Home just announced new contracts with Tufts and Adventist Health, both catalyzed by COVID. For Rafael, it's been especially mind-boggling to see business booming now.
So imagine if you had more outcome and more impact in 12 weeks than you had in 12 years. And I have mixed feelings. On one end, I feel great that, you know, our time has come. On the other hand, I feel if it came because of all of this pain and suffering, that makes me very sad. But that's the mix of feelings I have all day long now.
That story was reported by Dan Gorenstein. Whether hospital at home will really scale up and become more widely available depends on a couple of factors. For example, will insurers pay for it? And will hospitals keep their interest levels up once the pandemic is over? To hear the whole story, check out Trade-Offs. This episode is called Home Sweet Hospital. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for sending us all of those voice memos this week. Best place to find us is on Twitter at WHYY The Pulse. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.